You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Whatever we choose on Sunday, on Monday there will be absolutely nothing to divide us. Nobody doubts about our presence in Europe.
Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras insists that Sunday's divisive referendum will not divide his country. My guests Mary Dejevsky and Martin Plaut will be looking ahead to the vote and discussing the day's other big stories, including Burundi, which failed to heed warnings that botched parliamentary elections would result in violence, is now failing to heed warnings that its dubious presidential election will do the same. Malaysia's ongoing quest for an explanation for the shooting down of MH17 and justice for the victims, and Donald Trump doing more damage to the Republican brand than any Democrat could hope to. Why aren't his rival candidates shouting him down or shutting him up? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to today's programme. My guests are Mary Dejevsky, Chief Editorial Writer and Columnist at The Independent, and Martin Plaut, Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, both regular guests here. Welcome back. Athens, as we just heard, is preparing tonight for large rallies ahead of Sunday's referendum, one gathering for those intending to vote yes, one for those intending to vote no, though it would come as little surprise to see both dwarfed by an assembly of those who still don't quite understand the question on the ballot. The stakes are high in the event of a no vote. The ECB has made thinly veiled threats to cease emergency assistance to Greece's tottering banks. If it's yes, it seems unlikely that Greece's government can survive, on top of all of which Greece's highest administrative court has been trying to figure out if the whole thing is even legal, although in the last few minutes, just as while we've been on air, that court has rejected an appeal to block the referendum, so it looks like it will go ahead. Mary, I'll ask you first, does it actually matter if it's legal as such? The whole thing is a bit of a stunt, really, isn't it?
Well, I think it's a bit more of a stunt. And in some ways, it's actually worse than a stunt, because the effect of it could actually be real. And the problem is that the effect either of a yes vote or a no vote has bad implications on both sides. I mean, it's very difficult to see why this referendum was called, other than for the Prime Minister's sort of personal satisfaction, and as a bargaining chip with Brussels that went horribly wrong.
Martin Plaut, Prime Minister Tsipras has in the last few minutes also said that this isn't a referendum on Euro membership, but it is, isn't it?
Well, it may turn out to be.
Effectively.
Yes, effectively. I mean, the real difficulties, I think, are, you know, clearly economic. I mean, the politics of this is really neither here nor there. You know, they are up now against the reality of what it means to say, to, you know, thumb your nose at the European banking system, the IMF, everybody under the sun. And now they will see what it feels like. And that is going to be a horrible lesson for the Greeks, because in a sense, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that these institutions can afford not to exact a price. Because if they don't exact a price, they will indicate to everybody, well, you can do what you like, doesn't hurt, it's fine.
You think, just to follow up on that at some level the EU is starting to feel like an example needs to be made of somebody, and
yes,
Greece is the fall guy.
Yes, somebody has to be taken out to be shot.
It's a simile not far removed from the truth where Greece's immediate economic future is concerned. Tsipras, again, as we were just saying, Mary, he says it's not a referendum on Euro membership, but most Greek people going to vote on Sunday, and there are reports of many people flying home to vote, even if they don't actually understand the question or haven't read or comprehended the documents to which it refers, that will be how it's understood by most voters, will it not, that this is a referendum, Euro versus drachma, essentially?
Well, I think it will be understood in that sense by enough people actually to determine the vote one way or the other. And the interesting thing thing is that here you have a prime minister who is arguing huge public meetings. He's arguing for a no vote, which is not the normal position that that anybody who wants the result in a referendum, usually they're arguing for a yes vote. So he's arguing for a no vote. The point has been made that the no answer comes first on the ballot, which has been regarded as rather perverse. And the result of that is that, or at least one effect, will be that some people will be voting about Europe and Euro membership. Other people will be voting in what's essentially a vote of confidence in the Prime Minister. And that could swing a yes vote, which is not what he wants, because he would say that that weakens Greece's bargaining position vis-a-vis Brussels. But of course, Brussels is probably sitting there, everybody in Brussels and the banks, and thinking, well, a yes vote, if the Greek vote goes yes against the Prime Minister, then you've actually got, in a way, much more promising territory for negotiations, except that then Tsipras will have to consider his position.
I will acknowledge a bias here, as the bias of a broadcaster who about 2 years ago ran out of jokes about Greek choruses and Greek tragedies and Greek drama and what a Grecian earns and so forth. The polls are very close with perhaps
that is
some
terrible.
They were terrible 2 years ago, and they've just worn so thin ever since. The polls are very, very close. They're tending a minor bias towards a yes vote. If it's yes, Martin, does not this just lead to an increasingly absurd sequence of bailout after bailout after bailout? The IMF has recently said that Greece needs another 50 billion euros over the next 3 years.
I thought it was 60 billion. Yes, clearly it's that order of magnitude.
Tens of billions here, tens of billions there. Eventually you're talking about real money. Yeah.
Yes, but I mean, I think that is what it's going to take. And, what was fascinating was that I think it was Martin Wolf in the Financial Times was, interestingly, who's one of the most respected commentators on economic affairs there is in Britain, said actually he thought marginally it would probably be better for Greece to leave the euro, get back to the drachma, basically trash their currency, and then they could begin again. It'd be sort of the ground zero. But there's a wonderful cartoon in Handelsblatt, one of the German equivalent of the Financial Times, which shows Mr. Tsipras here with a gun to his head, and it says, "Give me the money, or I'll shoot myself." That kind of summarises the position.
It is a bizarre negotiating position that Mr. Tsipras has painted himself into. Mary, I was going to ask, not just in terms of the result of the vote, but the immediate consequences, what the best imaginable outcome is, but that's obviously a slightly fatuous question. Instead, I'll ask you, what is, in terms of result, immediate consequences, what is, from the point of view of the Greek people, the least worst imaginable outcome?
Well, my personal view, because I tend to think that Greece ought to stay in the euro, even though it's going to cost Brussels, that the integrity of the European financial system requires Greece to stay in the euro, that my preference would be for a yes vote and for Greece essentially to accept the conditions that are on offer. Now, the slight uncertainty about that is that Brussels seems uncertain whether what was on offer actually still is on offer, and therefore whether the question, the yes, no question, is actually valid. But my view is that a yes vote against the wishes of Tsipras is probably the best thing that could happen.
What do you think, Martin? What is the least worst available option?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think the best thing would be a yes vote. Tsipras goes. You have then a coalition government of the willing, which would include PASOK, the old Socialist Party, and some of the other parties. You cobble together a new government, because there's no time to form to have a new election. I mean, this is a crisis. I mean, we use the word much too loosely. This really is a crisis.
Indeed,
because
so.
Apparently Greece is likely to start running out of essential goods, because they can't import anything, because the banks are closed. They can't transfer money, even if they have it, to pay for the goods they need to import to keep themselves alive. So, this is really a crisis. They can't wait for an election. Therefore, they would have to put some coalition together. My only question, and this is something I'm not in a position to know, but I'm perhaps Mary, is is what about the army? Let's not forget that the army has in the past intervened.
In relatively recent memory, yes. This would be going back to the mid-70s, the last time that the colonels were in charge in Greece. Is that really likely at this point?
Well, I suppose if Greece had any sort of inclination to leave the European Union, not just the Euro, but the European Union, then I suppose a military coup would be bowing out in extreme fashion.
We will doubtless have ample opportunity to reflect on the consequences all next week. But another contentious vote took place earlier this week in Burundi. Parliamentary and local elections were boycotted by opposition parties and blighted by violence, leaving 6 people dead in the capital, Bujumbura. Unsurprisingly, the UN, which had called for the vote to be postponed, said the elections were neither free nor credible, and the country is now braced for a presidential election on July 15th, in which President Pierre Nkurunziza will stand for a third term in apparent defiance of the constitution he's supposed to be upholding. Martin, first of all, exactly how unfree and unfair were the elections on Monday?
Well, let's put it this way. They were so bad that the African Union, which has a pretty low threshold, thought it wasn't good enough to go and observe, and nor did the European Union.
Wow, okay.
So
That's the whole level below where sending observers, people say there's just no point.
Yes, exactly. They thought there was such a degree of violence and intimidation of journalists and of other politicians. The political opposition, as you say, boycotted it. So it wasn't really a serious election, and nor will the next one be. I mean, it's just Nkurunziza, unfortunately, hanging on to power, as all these African dinosaurs tend to. I mean, you know, there are plenty of them, from Robert Mugabe to, the Angolans, Equatorial Guinea, you know, the Obiangs of this world. I mean, they all hang on to power far too long and don't follow Nelson Mandela's wonderful example of resigning, just saying, I've done my job.
You would think they'd notice. They sort of like read his obituaries and thought maybe that'd be a nice way to be spoken about when I'm done.
Absolutely,
here.
But they don't learn.
But they don't. Mary, are there any inducements / threats that could or should be made to Nkurunziza at this point? The US has suspended already some security assistance and is making vague threats about trade preferences. But do you then end up in that position of looking like the rich white country trying to tell the poor black country how it should behave?
Yes, absolutely. And the classic example of that is Zimbabwe, where all the effects of what Britain and everybody and the Commonwealth and everybody threw at Zimbabwe have left Robert Mugabe in power to this day. So I think that's, you understand why, because there is nothing else to do. We've also seen that Belgium and probably France, I imagine, have immediately refused to accept the results such as they were of the elections, as we've said, we've got the problem of the presidential election in 2 weeks' time. But I actually have a question for Martin. It's something that I don't understand. But with the president sort of insisting that he wants an additional term outside the constitution, which is one of the sources of all the resistance. There is a view among, as we've said, all these, a lot of African autocrats, that only they can really keep a hold on what's going on. And sometimes the problem is that they're right. I mean, is he right? Are there other people there in the wings?
Well, there certainly would be people who could take over. The problem is that, leaders tend to rule in favour of themselves, but also of let's not beat about the bush, their tribe or their section of the tribe. And they will put huge resources towards that area and that place that they come from. And so the people associated with him could lose out if they are stripped of their position. I mean, if you look at the way in which someone like Jacob Zuma pours resources into Natal, well, he's putting his money where he came from. And if he loses out, then, the people in Natal will lose out. And since the Zulu are the largest ethnic group, they're pretty unhappy about that idea. But you mentioned that there was nothing that could be done about Zimbabwe. And of course, that's not true. Everybody forgets the Bara Patrol. The Royal Navy put ships off the coast of Mozambique when good old Smithy was in power upholding white rule for years and years, and eventually it made life extremely difficult to him. They could easily have done it again. They just chose not to. The problem was not that we did that we were hard on Mugabe, but that we weren't hard enough. And the same, in a sense, is this. But the other thing that's quite amusing at the moment is that the Rwandans next door are saying, oh, you know, really, you shouldn't go along with this third term. Why not have a, you know, allow people to go on? And yet in their own country, Paul Kagame is just orchestrating a campaign to, guess what? Have the constitution changed so that he can stay on.
Well, we are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, Mary Dujewski and Martin Plout. Coming up next, Malaysia's long search for justice for MH17 and the Republican Party's increasingly bizarre quest for a candidate.
The Big Interview is Monocle's series where our senior editors sit down with leading minds in politics, business, culture and design to find out what makes them tick and how they got to where they are. This Sunday at 9 a.m. London time, hear the acclaimed Turkish writer Elif Shafak speak to Monocle's Georgina Godwin about the art of storytelling, the state of Turkish society and the promise and power of language.
When you think, write, dream in another language, you earn an additional zone of freedom. Writing in English helps me to put a distance between myself and the land where I come from.
That's The Big Interview with Elif Shafak this Sunday at 9 a.m. right here on Monocle 24.
Top ingredients, world-class service, less foam and pretension, and honest food made with dedication. Monocle focuses on what we think really matters and launches the Monocle Restaurant Awards. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 to hear of the places we value highly, where we want to dine again and again, and where most restaurant ranking lists may not guide you to.
What does it look like? What is the vitality of this place on the street? And yes, the food has to be outstanding as well, but there are many other elements that go beyond that.
The nominees will be announced every Friday on our food and drink program, The Menu, and the winner will be announced in July. Don't miss out. Tune into The Menu every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Mary Dujewski and Martin Plout. It's 2 weeks short of a year since Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, a Boeing 777 flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, crashed in eastern Ukraine with the loss of all 298 passengers and crew. Myriad explanations for the disaster of widely varying sanity have been advanced, but the simplest one that fits the facts is that MH17 was shot down by Ukrainian separatists equipped with Russian-supplied anti-aircraft missiles. Malaysia has now said that it wants to establish an international tribunal to prosecute those responsible. Mary, it's a joint proposal with the Netherlands, Australia, Belgium and Ukraine. Three of those countries, of course, lost large numbers of nationals on the flight. Ukraine was where the plane came down. Is this idea actually somewhat overdue?
Well, it is overdue. I mean, in some ways, that is where things should have started. And there are some very peculiar things about this investigation, not least how long it's taken. There isn't going to be a proper report out until, I think, sometime late in the autumn. And
there has been a preliminary report, of course.
There's been a preliminary report, but the preliminary report was, in a way, worse than useless, because it steered clear of really everything that anybody wanted to find out. So it didn't come to any conclusion, not just about even whether it had been shot down, let alone by whom. And, you know, I know that the Malaysians are deeply unhappy about this. They're probably the most unhappy because at least the Netherlands feel that they're somehow involved in the mainstream and they are sort of responsible for the investigation. But the Malaysians feel completely cut out of the whole process. And they think that it will be subject, that the end report and the end conclusions will be subject to politics and it will be the result of three-corner wrangling between Russians, Americans, and the Netherlands. And they're not at all convinced that either that the truth is going to come out or, in their view, that justice will be done.
Just to follow that up, though, Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister, Gennady Gatilov, has said that the investigation is, and I quote, not timely and counterproductive. Isn't this basically the problem here, that any sort of satisfactory conclusion is going to require rather more cooperation from Russia than is likely to be forthcoming?
Well, I don't get the impression, actually, that the Russians are not cooperating. I think that the Russians do have an interest in cooperation. And one of the problems from their perspective is that because, in my view at least, the degree of control that Russia has over the rebels in the east and over the territory in the east, that they can't find out the actual facts either. Now, I know that that's not necessarily a popular or mainstream view, but I think Russia is much more hobbled in this investigation than a lot of people believe.
Martin, why doesn't Russia, or indeed why didn't Russia, take the opportunity to just... I don't know, there was a chance here where, oh, okay, this is going to need to be carefully phrased. You can't really come out and look like a good guy when your proxies have just shot down a civilian airliner full of, you know, entirely blameless people who meant you no harm at all. But there was an opportunity there for Russia to at least come clean on that and say, look, something terrible has happened in a conflict to which we at least have some sort of interest. You know, we will fence this off from everything else we're dealing with and just make sure this gets sorted out. Why not do that?
Well, because it would mean standing up your buddies. I mean, you know, if it was shot down by their proxies and they turn round and point the finger at them, well, that, and especially if the missiles were supplied not just by their proxies but by the Russians themselves, if it turns out to be a Russian-supplied missile, and I don't know what kind of missile it was, then, you know, you're in a sense pointing the finger at yourself. Well, I don't think that's Mr. Putin's way of doing things. And my question really, I mean, I'd be interested to hear what Mary has to say, is even if this tribunal turns around and says, yes, it was the Russians what done it or their proxies, then what? How do you get them to pay up?
Well, I think that if the conclusion was that Russia did it, I think that there would be not just dissent, but extreme anger in the Kremlin, because there, you know, there is a sort of view that somehow Putin sat in the Kremlin and either ordered or presided for a major air disaster to happen. And I think this is absolutely miles from the truth. I also think that all the talk of missiles and missile batteries crossing borders from Russia and then crossing them back, that is very dubious, because it wasn't necessary. There is masses
missile batteries
of Russian...
They came from somewhere, though, the missile
batteries.
Yes,
but there are plenty of missile batteries that are in Ukraine already, because Russia was always the main supplier. And, you know, they were part of the same country until the end of 91. And there is masses of Russian military hardware washing around in Ukraine. And that's one of the problems, because it's very difficult to separate what may have been coming in over the border from Russia and what was actually there already. And I think that's really not been taken sufficiently into account.
Martin, that all being the case, is it likely that even if this investigation or even if this international tribunal is established, that there will ever be a universally agreed narrative on what happened here? Because even if it is sort of the most clear-cut case imaginable, absolute black-and-white evidence was found saying that this was a Russian-supplied missile, it was fired by Russian-backed separatists, the culpability is at least partially Russia's, there's no way at all, is there, that Russia's going to say, yeah, well, sorry about that.
No, I think that's highly unlikely. But, I mean, then, you know, how many narratives are still open? I mean, if you look at, say, Kashmir, the dispute between India and Pakistan, there's no agreement on what happened even in the few days when the whole thing blew up, you know, after the separation of Pakistan from India. I mean, there's no agreement at all. So the world is perfectly happy to have unresolved conflicts with unresolved borders and unresolved narratives.
I mean, I think the world may be happy with that situation, but the people who most aren't in this situation are actually the Malaysians.
And what power do they have?
Exactly.
Well, finally tonight, we may have reached the point at which the Republican Party starts wondering whether or not Donald Trump is in fact an agent operated by the Democrats, although it's at least arguable that in a field also containing Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, Trump isn't even the most ridiculous available option. Hispanic leaders are warning the GOP that Trump's recent idiotic remarks about Mexicans will scupper the Republicans' chances in a country in which angry middle-aged white men are no longer as demographically dominant as they once were. Martin, I don't think we need to sort of spend too much time parsing Donald Trump's remarks about Mexicans or indeed Trump's remarks about anything at all. What's interesting is why so many other Republican candidates are being either equivocal or silent.
Well, because you've got to look at the sort of hardcore base of the Republican Party. Now, I'm not a specialist on American politics, but it does seem to me that exactly the people who you've been pointing to as not being the major demographic are still at the heart of the party. I mean, you know, the Tea Party is, you know, these are the kind of remarks they go down quite well there. And, you know, he says things which people sort of, he's the pub gossip. He's the sort of UKIP candidate for wherever it is, South Georgia or somewhere. Do you see what I mean? That is his position. And he has gone up in the polls in America. He is increasingly popular. He's only, what, he's now, what, Jeb Bush is 19 points and Trump is 12. So he's doing pretty well on these remarks.
12 by some polls. An average of polls puts him puts him 8th out of 15 candidates. That said, I think if I declared for the Republican candidacy at this point, I'm top 10 material on that score, and I'm constitutionally ineligible to stand. Mary, is that basically the point, that the Republican Party is now caught in this demographic bind between it doesn't want to alienate Hispanics or indeed other minorities, obviously, because if you do that, you can't win the White House anymore, but if it doesn't do that a bit, it alienates that quite cranky core of people who really don't like Hispanics or other ethnic minorities.
Yes, I mean, they're really stuck in the middle. And of course, this was about Mexicans. So that's an additional, that's sort of extra Hispanic, if you like, because they're the other side of the border. So I think there is a problem that if as a budding Republican candidate, you're going to look too kind in that direction, then you're going to lose part of the constituency you need, not to get elected, it has to be said, but to win the primary, to win the nomination. And it's always said that on either party, you have to move to the left if you're a Democrat in order to get the nomination, then you have to move back to the centre. And the same is true of Republicans. You have to campaign for the nomination on a right-wing platform and then move to the centre. And one of the best people at doing that was actually George W. Bush. And Jeb Bush should be good at that. And he's also got credibility on the Mexican question because he's actually married to a Mexican.
He's married to a Mexican. He speaks very, very good Spanish. And he's talked a relative compassionate sense on immigration. But again, that may ruin his chances of winning the primary. Martin, it just strikes me that the GOP has not learned anything since 2012, in which they should have learned that if you have to spend 2 years pretending to be insane in order to win the nomination, you're not going to get elected.
Well, yes, but, you know, I think we're all being too hard on Mr. Trump. I think
really?
I have a soft...
I've barely started.
I have a soft spot for him. First of all, because he is in that rare group of politicians who have the idiotic hairstyle. And I think that makes him already, you know, a bigger plus in my book.
He would be the first bald president since Eisenhower.
I'm delighted to hear it. And then he's a bit like Boris Johnson. Comes out with a utterly wacky, you know, the problem with politics is that there are so many non-entities. At least you cannot say that about Mr. Trump.
Well, I can think of one or two other political figures down the ages who you couldn't call non-entities either, and it wasn't necessarily an endorsement.
Yeah, but they're all sterilized by their media advisors these days. They are so blooming dull. He's not.
This is certainly true, but Mary, is there a point that He does just suck the air out of the contest, because basically this is eventually, ideally, a job for a serious person, which Donald Trump is clearly not.
Well, I think we're very far away, both from the nominating primaries and from the election itself. And so I think that Americans, too, actually like to have some fun in the preliminary stages. And if they get it from Donald Trump, then why not?
We have to hope you're right. Mary Dajewski and Martin Plaut, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tamor Haveda Williams. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Chris Lord in Istanbul is keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie is here with the menu. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns on Monday, 1800 London time. For this edition, it's goodbye. Have a great weekend.